This week in Retronauts, Saraba, Mata Aohi Made. Welcome back to Retronauts, a very special episode of Retronauts. Maybe a sad episode of Retronauts. Maybe not so sad, because we're all here to remember someone who meant a lot to us, and hopefully meant a lot to a lot of you out there listening, because we wanted to have a special episode to memorialize Akira Toriyama, who wrote and drew and just made so many little things, so many special little guys over the years, and his recent passing, I think, took the entire world, like literally the entire world, by surprise. There are life forms deep inside the Earth's crust who have read Akira Toriyama's work and just said, wait, that guy? He's not here anymore? What the hell? Speaking of little guys, I'm not too tall myself. My name is Diamond Fight. Let's introduce the other people here joining me for this somewhat solemn episode that I've already spoiled the mood of. We'll start with the North American East. Let's say American branch.
That would be Kevin Bunch. Hello.
Hello, Kevin. Let's go up to Canada.
Hey, everybody. It's Bob Mackey. I'm currently holding the very non-ergonomics PS2 slime controller, courtesy of my wife. Yeah. I didn't buy this.
Oh, excellent. Yes. I also... It's hard to handle. I see that's a metal slime. They're quick to run away. So
yeah, analog sticks are very, very tiny on this.
And also joining me here in Japan, not physically, but, you know, in the
mentally.
Nation. Yes.
I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us, Matt. I needed at least one professionally certified expert, even though, you know.
Certified by who? I don't know. But yeah, certifiable, maybe.
The International Podcasting Board.
It's always a pleasure. Even if this is a sad occasion, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine any one person who had such an incredible impact on pop culture globally as Akira Toriyama. I mean, manga, of course, which is where he got his start, anime, games, you know, narrative entertainment, and also in some surprising places like the world of emoji, where when I was investigating that for a book I wrote on it years back, I learned from many emoji architects that his anthropomorphic poop from Dr. Slump is the inspiration for the poop emoji. So, I mean, he's really everywhere. It's pretty incredible.
You have to wonder.
That's a legacy.
Yeah, you have to wonder, in his wildest dream of dreams, did he ever expect he would create a character that would be voiced by Patrick Stewart one day?
I was going to go there, Diamond. I was going to say, whenever you're watching the Emoji Movie, you see Patrick Stewart, you could say, thank you, Mr. Toriyama. I don't want that to be his legacy, though. I apologize.
Hey, man, everybody poops. It's an okay legacy. It's fine.
Yes. Not one I wanted to see on screen, but it's all right. It's for the kids. It's for the kids. So yeah, as far as how this episode is going to work, I mean, the four of us here, we're not biographers. We're not statisticians. We have, I think I can safely say that none of us have ever met Akira Toriyama, right?
Unfortunately.
No, but we're all fans of what he did. And we just wanted to come together and talk about, you know, who he was and what he made and perhaps what that meant to us. And so in that spirit, I threw together some notes just about, you know, his life and, you know, the big hits of his life. And just to go from there, I guess we could start by just saying that he was born in a small town outside Nagoya, which I would say is definitely one of Japan's, let's say, lesser sung cities. It's a big city,
it's Detroit.
Yeah, it's in the middle. It's not near Tokyo. It's not really that near Osaka. But it's a major metropolis, and lots of people live there.
It has great miso.
Yeah.
It was great miso.
You know, I had a great time in Nagoya recently, and I told a Japanese citizen this, and they laughed at me. because
it's, right. It's like in Detroit. I loved it. It's great this time of year. No,
it's like the Pittsburgh
Detroit.
Of Japan, the Pittsburgh, yes, Pennsylvania, exactly. Or something like that.
Wow. Not only is it the Pittsburgh of Japan, but Toriyama grew up quite impoverished. His family was, according to some comments that I was reading by his editor, Mr. Torishima, who I'm sure we're going to be getting into a little bit later. His family was so poor that they often couldn't even afford food. And that was one of the big reasons that he sort of, you know, obsessed over drawing. You know, it's something you can do with just a pencil and a piece of paper. But in spite of their poverty, according to Mr. Torishima, it's still like a very bright, upbeat kind of, they were just like super laid back. And so it wasn't like a traumatic poor upbringing. You know, there wasn't any, there was no abuse going on or anything like that. It just sounds like they were poor. And, but that fueled his, you know, escapes into fantasy and into, you know, burnishing his drawing abilities and things like that.
You know, hearing that makes a lot of sense when we get to, you know, his education and what he does right after he graduates high school. That's
right.
That makes sense. Yeah, according to all sources, he was drawing basically his entire life. He was doing a lot of drawing as a kid. I saw a note that he won several contests in elementary school. It was Japanese. They said chasse, which I'm assuming is like a life drawing. So maybe like some models or animals or.
He in his early interviews, he said there was like there was an old dude in the neighborhood who ran I'm not sure if it was a studio or a shop or something like that, but it was like a drawing classroom.
Okay.
And he would have kids come in and draw. He would teach them drawing techniques. And apparently Toriyama, at some point the guy had a contest to draw Dalmatians from the 101 Dalmatians.
Right.
And Toriyama was kind of obsessed with that cartoon as a kid. You know, age 5, 6, and he entered the contest. And I don't know that he won it, but the guy running the teacher, if you want to call him that, selected his work to display. And that was like a huge, huge moment for him that he felt like his art could reach it. But it's interesting. It's another crossover of Disney and Japanese pop culture. You know, famously Osamu Tezuka of Astro Boy and, you know, Kimba the White Lion and, you know, so many other, you know, formative manga was deeply, deeply, deeply influenced by Disney. So as much as we like to say anime, it's like a Japan thing. It's actually a crossing of many cultural streams. And Toriyama's another great example of that.
Yeah. And right alongside 101 Dalmatians, of course, Toriyama cites Tezuka's, Adam Boy as Astro Boy. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, hey, same thing.
I fudged two words there, but... You know, he cites that as another influence, that'll be also relevant later when one of Toriyama's biggest hits. But yeah, so as a kid, he's drawing. As a teenager, he's drawing. You know, he's always just drawing stuff around the house, and he goes to a design school. He's drawing in high school, and as soon as he graduates from high school, he gets a job right away. Which I think follows very closely to what you were saying about his, you know, his upbringing. Like he probably needed work. So like, okay, I'm out of high school. Let's get to work. And he found work for an advertising company. He was doing a lot of designing work, and he only sticks it with it a couple of years because he doesn't really, I think, take to the culture of the job. It sounds like he's late a lot. Apparently he shows up dressed too casually for work.
That was a big deal back then.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. There are companies that are still today who are still like,
yeah,
this is
the 70s, just to give some context here. This must have been like 1975-ish.
But yeah, he also apparently has to do a lot of lettering, which he's not a fan of. I think he likes the drawing. I think he likes drawing super, you know, super little guys there, but I think he's less fond of drawing like little letters over and over again. So he quits in 77. So here he is. He's 22 years old and he's out of work. I found a good quote from him, which I would say in English. It's like, it wasn't a waste of time because I was able to learn a little bit about how the world works.
Deep.
But armed with that knowledge and very little money, he's doing odd jobs, and he sees a random flyer in a coffee shop for an amateur manga contest. And he's like, oh, I draw. Let's do this. And I love this point. Apparently, he he looked at the contest and he saw what the prize was, and he saw there were categories for like story manga, I guess like serious story, and gag manga, which is like whatever the hell you want to draw. And according to the source that I saw, he picked the gag manga because the prize money was the same, but the gag manga required half as many pages right. to submit. So
I think this story manga, by the way, was a term coined in like the 60s, I think, to distinguish serious, like basically graphic novels from comics and cartoons, which is what at that point, like Tezuka and people were seen as drawing. And so it's actually like a genre in Japanese, story manga.
Okay. Is that like Gekiga or is that something else?
Yeah, it's kind of, actually, I shouldn't say to differentiate from Tezuka, because Tezuka's stuff was also seen as story manga too, but just narrative based, more mature storytelling. Mm-hmm. And yeah, definitely Gekiga, a lot of Gekiga would have been in that, in Gekiga being like dramatic pictures. This is like the kind of more rough hewn manga that came out in the 60s. And actually the manga that is consumed today is all descended from Gekiga. It's not really descended from what was known as manga in the 60s, but, it's all come to be known as manga, even in Japan. We're really in the weeds, but that is true. That is 100% true.
You were mentioning Diamond. He entered the contest that required the fewer amount of pages. Some of the funniest stuff in Dr. Slump, which we'll talk about soon, are the autobiographical sections where he's always talking about his bad work ethic. He talks about living with his parents. He talks about how he's always late delivering pages to the airport to be flown out to, I assume, Tokyo to be to Shonen Jump's offices.
I love that he opted for the gag manga option because it was less work. And then he becomes famous for like these weekly comics that require just a massive amount of effort to get out the door constantly. Like, wow, you worked your way into it.
Although it's, you know, his first couple of attempts at making serialized manga were epic failures, though. You know, the first stuff that he submitted to Shonen Jump, you know, he met an editor there, Torishima, who was kind of took him under his wing, but you know, everybody thinks of, we only think of Toriyama as being this kind of like insane success now, but he's actually kind of a Dragon Ball-esque, you know, this little puny artist who just keeps getting knocked down over and over again and perfects his skills and perfects his storytelling and like finds friends who, you know, who he can, you know, fight alongside and then like finally, you know, powers up as a Super Saiyan and becomes the Toriyama that we know today.
Starts off in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, we mentioned Torishima several times now, and of course, you know, Shonen Jump, which would end up being Toriyama's home for his work for many, many decades. But the irony of all this is that the flyer he sees for a contest is not for Shonen Jump, it's for Weekly Shonen Magazine. And in preparing his submission, he actually missed the deadline.
Oops!
So he ends up hanging on to what he drew and sends it to Shonen Jump because they had another contest, like, I guess a few months later in 78. So talk about quits. That's what ends up getting him to Shonen Jump and eventually meeting Torishima, which he said later on in interviews years later, he said it was indeed very confusing. The fact that he's Toriyama and his editor with Torishima and those names are, you know, even all in Japanese, Tories. Those are pretty similar. Yeah.
Birds. It's all birds. Actually, no, it's funny that they're both named Bird and Toriyama's called Bird Studio because I really think manga is like the jazz of Japan. And Toriyama to me is like Bird, like Charlie Parker. He's like this just innovator. Obviously minus the heroin addiction and all and all of that stuff that the jazz greats had. But just this wild, wild innovator. Like and losing him is really like the jazz world losing one of those greats.
Yeah, Torishima makes a lot of appearances in his comics, and he looks just like a regular button-down, you know, Japanese businessman now. But in those comics, he's got this big, bushy afro.
Yes.
So when you say Torishima, I think of what he looked like, I don't know, circa 1981.
Well, he's Dr. Masharito, right? In Dr. Slump, you know, because Toriyama is constantly battling with him, not like in a hateful way, but just like they're constantly, constantly wrestling and arguing. And so he named the antagonist of Dr. Slump Dr. Masharito, which is Torishima written backwards. And so in the pages of the book, you know, Of course that guy always gets his ass kicked nonstop by like Arare-chan and the rest of the characters. And I'm sure that must have given Toriyama some kind of satisfaction, you know, because he has to do everything Torishima says in the business world. But on the pages of the manga, it's Toriyama who's king.
And, you know, what's Torishima going to do? Because this story took off and was very popular. Yeah. So, like, you can't.
No, he loved it. He loved
it. Can't mess with it.
He loved it. There's a lot. We should get into the whole Torishima Toriyama thing because, you know, Toriyama's rise to success is actually, it's due to his insane and amazing talent, but it's also due to this collaboration with this editor guy.
Yeah, I would say, you know, based on the recent episodes I've done, you know, we're talking today about Toriyama, but a few months ago I had an episode about Fist of the North Star. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading into that, it's like, Fist of the North Star, when we talk about it, it's usually, we mention, you know, Bronson,
right,
the writer, and Tetsuo Ohara, the artist. But it's like, the third collaborator, the less than collaborator, was their editor, you know, who was constantly giving them ideas. And in the case of Fist of the North Star, like, he was the one who said, hey, what if you do, like, a guy who, like, uses acupuncture to make people explode? Like, oh, that's a good idea.
Why didn't I think of that? Yeah, I don't think Westerners get how much of a collaborative medium manga is. It's really like an editor's medium. You know, anime is a director's medium. Manga is 100% an editor's medium, especially at the higher echelons like Jump.
But yeah, his relationship with Torishima is definitely a part of what drives him forward. I wanted to highlight, so what Toriyama eventually creates and submits is something he calls a Wawa World, which is just as goofy as it sounds. It's just like, it's feudal Japan, but also there's UFOs, there's bunny girls, there's a big muscle guy who looks like Superman, but he's called Nikuman, which of course is a pun, because Nikuman is what you call a meat bun here in Japan, and Niku is also the kanji used in muscle, which is also funny to me because I looked it up, and apparently Awa World's Nikuman predates the manga hero Kin Nikuman, who's now famous, by like a matter of months, so he just got under the line there. And wow. You know, of course, there's dinosaurs walking around because that's what Toriyama's going to do. Like, dinosaurs are walking everywhere. And, you know, the submission does not win any prizes. No. And the note that Torishima sends back to him, which I have here, is like, you're not good. You're not good. But if you stick with this, it might turn into something. So keep drawing and send it to me. So, like, Torishima is very clear, like, I don't like this, but I want more of this. You know, keep going. Don't stop.
He recognized a diamond in the rough.
Yeah. Just like me. Sorry. Uncalled for.
So, yeah, you know, it's actually most of the stuff that we associate with Toriyama all came from Torishima. Like Dr. Slump, the way that it played out was Torishima's idea. You know, Toriyama wanted to make Dr. Slump about like this mad scientist guy.
Yeah.
And it was Torishima who's like, actually, no, it's about the girl, Rare-chan. And, you know, Toriyama is like, nuh-uh. And, you know, they got into this whole thing where it turned into a bet. Where Torishima is basically like, okay, I'll tell you what. Let's just do a special episode where it's all about the little girl and let's see how it does in the reader rankings. And if it's number one, I'm right. And if it's anything less than number one, you're right and you can do whatever you want. And of course, it came back and it was number one. And so Toriyama had to shift, because he lost that bet, he had to shift the entire focus of the manga to focus on Rare-chan. But he refused to compromise. Torishima wanted him to change the title, too, to make it Rare-chan. And he refused. He was stubborn. He refused on that, and it stayed Dr. Slump, which was like a huge, like, you know, when you talk to Japanese people, everybody remembers Dr. Slump. They remember Rare-chan, and nobody understands, well, why was it called Dr. Slump? Like, he really should have renamed it. It's the anime is called Rare-chan. It's like, yes. Rare-chan in big letters and then underneath it, Dr. Slump. And it's really common to rename cartoon versions of manga, but it's just funny. It's like a bet. It's like this whole thing, like this massive, and it ended up selling 35 million copies. So, you know, good bet, Mr. Torishima.
It's a real Popeye situation. You know, what if they didn't change the name away from Thimble Theater eventually? Yeah.
What
if
it was just, is that what Popeye was? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because Popeye didn't show up for like a decade. So
wow.
It was Thimble Theater for a long time. Then he showed up. It was still Thimble Theater. And then finally they're like, well, Popeye's the character everybody loves. Let's just change the name of it to Popeye. So this is sort of like the reverse of that.
Totally.
I would say in Japan, especially, I bet very few people here would know the name Peanuts. You know,
everyone
in Japan knows Snoopy, and a lot of them know Charlie Brown and that
Charlie
sort of
Brown,
thing. But like, yeah, the comic strip is called Peanuts, and I think very few Japanese people probably have heard of Peanuts at all.
Well, it's funny. I don't think most Americans would know. Why is it called Peanuts? I guess it's because it's like an old, you know, school way of calling little kids little kids.
I know this because I recently read the Charles Schulz biography that came out like a decade ago. It was named after the peanut gallery in the Howdy Doody show. That's where the little kids sat. And Charles Schulz hated that title, but his editors were not as great as Torishima's. But no, I've heard a few stories about Torishima and his contributions to Dragon Ball. One of the more famous stories is that Toriyama wanted the Red Ribbon Saga in the adult Goku parts of the story to be Goku fighting one old man. And he thought, what if there were some cool teens, some cool teen androids? What about then? And then he added the two different androids, and it was a very successful story. Who knows what people would have thought of it? It was, you know, Goku beating up an old man.
Yeah, it's just like Santa Claus, like Goku. Yes. Goku beats the crap out of Santa Claus. Take that, you invincible bringer of presents. Although I wouldn't put it past Toriyama to put something like that in one of his manga, you know?
Yeah, I feel like he could make that work.
He could totally make. If he could make talking,
he could make
work,
anything work.
To make anything work. Actually, it's funny not to keep bringing this back to poop, but I actually think that, you know, when he debuted that character, it was this real power move in a sense. Like, I can make anything funny. You know what I mean? I can make a character out of anything. Like, he's literally turning shit to gold. So it's like, you know, this is Toriyama coming into his powers and showing them as only Toriyama can. You know what I mean?
I mean, if we have to have characters based on excrement, I'd rather have the Toriyama version than like a Mr. Hankey. You know what I mean?
Oh, totally. No, yeah. No. I mean, I don't think many Westerners are aware, especially if you're, you know, haven't spent time in Japan in the 80s. And I don't blame you, especially if you weren't alive. But if you spend time in Japan in the 80s, Toriyama's like art style, that super deformed, kawaii, like they call it, it's kind of, there's a style now called chibi that's a sort of offshoot of it, but it was just ubiquitous. He literally and profoundly transformed Japanese pop aesthetics almost single-handedly. You know, you'd had Hello Kitty, you'd had Doraemon. Suddenly you have this entire, but those are like kind of like standalone characters. Now you have this fully fleshed out, like incredibly detailed world where everything is kawaii, you know, whether it's like the characters, whether it's like a tank, whether it's like, you know, whatever, with the mountains, like, you know, this, it's this kind of animistic, you know, the sun has a smiling face. Everything does. Kind of reminds me of, would Metal Slug exist without Toriyama? You know what I mean? Because Metal Slug to me has that. Doesn't it have a Dr. Slump ish? It's like a heavily armed Dr. Slump world to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, the details on all the machines is very like Toriyama.
Totally, because Toriyama is kind of like a weaponized Sanrio to me in a lot of ways. Like, you know, you have Sanrio, you have Hello Kitty, and she stands for everything that's like, you know, innocent and pure. And like Toriyama is like, he's that, but also like adolescent, puerile, you know, vulgar, violent in a kind of fun way. He manages to work like the entire world into this really silly squashed format. And I think that's probably his biggest legacy in the long run, even bigger than Dragon Ball.
Well, before we even get to Dragon Ball, we should talk about probably Dr. Slump at length. Dr. Slump is not, we should also stress, Slump is not his first manga to get in the magazine. He has a bunch of, you know, shorter things that pop up. And as Matt mentioned earlier, there were reader feedback surveys, and usually whatever Toriyama created would end up in dead last place. You know, what was it? Wonder Island 2.
Yeah, you don't even remember these things anymore, right?
Yeah. It's just a lot of these stuff would get published later on when he's already a success. Like republished, sort of like almost like the Stephen King, like Bachman books kind of thing. But like at the time in the late 70s, like they appear and they go away, and no, this isn't going to work. But eventually he does settle on Dr. Slump after talking with his editor, negotiating things out. I would say if you look at Dr. Slump, it's very clear to me that the mad scientist character whose name, we should also say the name of the character, as so many characters are all puns, Senbei Norimaki. Those are like two different kinds of rice cracker.
Yep.
that character to me, if you look at him, it very clearly reads as Toriyama to me, like a self-insert kind of thing. The fact that he's a, you know, he works a lot of stuff, like his the whole name, Dr. Slump, the idea is like he's an inventor and none of his stuff works. So like, right. He's always like in a slump. That's the idea. Even Arai-chan, who like he's his greatest creation, a literal robot child, like she's super strong. She can do all this great stuff, but she's nearsighted, so she has to wear glasses. Like right away, it's like, yeah, he got it right, and he also got it wrong at the same time. Those glasses, by the way, even today, 45 years later, you look up like Arai-chan glasses in Japanese, and you'll see them. Like that's how they're known today. They're still known. Her glasses are still famous.
Yeah, I've read about half of Dr. Slump, and what surprised me is that it's kind of like Mad Magazine, that it's mostly parodies, at least the portion I read, where they do a story, but with the characters of Dr. Slump playing all of the roles. And one thing that blew my mind is we were all making the same jokes about Akira Toriyama when he hit it big in the West. All of the popular jokes about his art style and his storylines and so on. He was making those jokes about himself in the early 80s. There's one gag in Dr. Slump where one female character has to disguise themselves as another. And the joke is the artist can only draw one face, so she's perfectly fine passing as the other character. So, yeah, he knew that about himself long before we were making the one face jokes about Akira Toriyama's female characters.
He was very self-aware, that's for sure. And I think we should probably inject here, Dr. Slump has been available in English for quite some time through Viz. And those were translated by a good buddy of mine, Alexander O. Smith, who also did the Final Fantasy games, Gyakuten Saiban, Phoenix Wright games, a lot of other stuff. So it killed me. I don't know how it got to him. Because Hiroko and I really wanted to translate Dr. Slump. In the end, we ended up getting Doraemon. So that was like a big thing that we did. But Alex did it. He did a great job on it, too. So that's when you are reading Dr. Slump in English, you are reading the translations of the same gent who did Final Fantasy. What did he do? 10, 10, 2, 12? The even-numbered Final Fantasies. The even-numbered double-digit Final Fantasies, or many of them in the lower digit counts. That's Alex.
Yeah, that's right. He did the Arigato, I love you, right? That was him.
Yes. That was the groundbreaking translation of Arigato as I love you, which actually is a really deft translation. Hiroko and I use it when we're giving localization seminars and stuff like that sometimes.
Silliness and for all it's just like off the wall humor, Dr. Slump is a huge hit. You know, it's published for 4 years. It wins the Shogakukan Manga Award. It was at the time they didn't do shonen and shoujo like separately, like they just had one category for both. Dr. Slump wins the award in 1981, which I think interestingly the same year Doraemon wins the Kids Award, like just to give you a context, like that's what's blowing up in Japan at the time. But the success makes Toriyama an instant celebrity. You know, apparently at the same time as he's getting married, news comes out that he's one of the most like wealthiest entertainers in Japan, which is kind of a wild break. So, you know, in his recent passing, Fuji TV went ahead into their archives. Fuji TV has footage of his wedding ceremony, like because he's already famous. Like the media's there showing up, filming him, cutting his wedding cake. Like he's already a star. Which is
kind of Japan. Can you imagine like a comic, like even like Frank Miller's wedding? Like, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, we do have celebrity, you know, artists in the West, you know, America, England, places like that. But, you know, they're only celebrities in their fields. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Toriyama was like a literal society-wide, you know, celeb.
Yeah, I don't want to see Frank Miller's wedding. I'm just throwing that out there. Maybe it's for the best.
I think you filmed that for the police, just so they know what she looks like, so they can find her later. dark joke.
Darkness. Yeah. Get back to the fun.
Which is funny to me, because I also found this anecdote, because, you know, Akira Toriyama, that is his name. That's his actual name. And apparently early on, like, he had a chance. He could have picked a pen name. A lot of people picked name. You know, Bronson is obviously a pen name. Fujiya Fujiko is a pen name. Apparently he decided to go with a pen. He didn't choose a pen name because he thought it wouldn't matter. Like, this isn't going to sell. This is just something. This is something to make a living. I'll sell it and then I'll make some money and then I'll do something else. And once he got it, once he hit it big and people started like calling him up and like making jokes, because apparently there weren't that many Akira Toriyamas in the Nagoya area. So they found his house.
Right.
And I found a quote. He said, "My biggest regret is drawing comics using my real name." Like, he didn't, yes, he didn't want that, you know.
You know, manga artists are super reclusive in Japan. Most of them, like, you know, Demon Slayer, it's drawn by a mangaka called Gotouge Yoshiharu. Very androgynous sounding. To this day, it's not even clear what their gender is. It's believed the person's a woman, but I mean, nobody knows what their face look like. And that's really common. But Toriyama was really out there in the 80s. Like, there's a lot of photographs of him posing with other famous people, like Jackie Chan. There's a Jackie Chan photo with him. And there's one that I just dug up recently of him and Senna, the F1 driver, which I was just like, wow, what is this crossover? The guy who died in 1994 in a race. He's just doing all sorts of, you know, kind of appearances. So under his real name, which is just super uncommon. Like, I don't know whether it's that manga artists in Japan tend to be really introverted, or whether it's, you know, just some kind of game that they're playing with the readers, or some combination of the two. But Toriyama sort of, like you said, is not part of that mold.
I have heard that he was fairly shy as a person.
Oh, yeah.
I saw some anecdotes about how his co-workers on Chrono Trigger couldn't even get an autograph from him for their kids, because he just didn't want to interact with anybody. So,
you know, lots of people were posting that picture. It's Akira Toriyama, Yuji Horii, and Sakaguchi together in front of the Chrono Trigger TV. They look like the coolest group of math teachers you've ever seen in your life. They are so adorably dorky, but also a little cool. A little cool.
I don't think Toriyama, you know, it when you say he was working together with the Chrono Trigger team, I would bet you anything that he wasn't ever there. Like, I
would agree.
Yeah, like, you know, I remember reading when he wasn't involved with the anime productions of his works at all. Like, he didn't, other than like providing, you know, some rough sketches and things like that. He's a mangaka, and which is really interesting, because I think most people know, whether it's Dr. Slump and Japanese people, whether it's people all over the world and Dragon Ball or Dragon Quest even, or Chrono Trigger, most people know his work from non-manga sources, games, cartoons, mm-hmm. Or even like, you know, products, you know, merchandise and stuff like that. He's sold insane amounts of his manga, but generally speaking, I think most people interact with him indirectly. So it kind of makes sense that even the creative teams of like Dragon Quest, you know, when we were working on the Dragon Quest games, you know, my company localized 7 and 8. We never, you know, we met Yuji Horii once, and then, you know, we never had any interaction, of course, with Toriyama. It's like, you know, those people are off in Valhalla where everybody else is down in the, you know, slogging through the mud in the trenches. So, you know.
Yeah, I get the impression that he became a celebrity not by any choice. I think he probably made the most of it. You know, I think if Jackie Chan says, "Hey, I want to meet you," you say yes, no matter the yes, circumstances. But you know, I dug up an old interview. He was on Tetsuko no Heya, you know, the very long running interview series here in Japan. It looks like it's from like 83 or so. I found it on YouTube, and it's been subtitled in English. And you know, he's on TV. He knows the cameras are there, but he seems very uncomfortable with the whole thing. Like, I don't know how she talked him into this, but he's there and like he answers her questions. But he's sort of like, yeah, thank you, Like, he's very soft spoken. So I have no doubt that in any other circumstances, he would much rather, you know, if maybe she duped him. Maybe she said, "Hey, why don't you come up to Tetsuko's room?" And like, he assumed like he would just be in a room with Tetsuko. Right, like, exactly. No, this is actually a giant studio, and we're just going to sit here and talk in front of cameras. He's like, "Ah, you got me."
She's lucky he didn't chew his leg off to get out of the trap or something like that. You know what? You're shocked that like a manga artist is a total nerd. I'm just, wow. You know, it's like what a mind blowing revelation, huh? But yeah, he's such a gentle soul. Do you know what I mean? It's not that he's socially awkward so much as he's just normal. You know, it's like you throw anybody in a room with like 50 cameras pointing at them and lights, and they're gonna freeze up.
Yeah, I guess we should point out that manga authors, they have assistants, they have help, but they are required to put out much more work than Western artists, and that could lead to why they are so reclusive and introverted, because they don't see people that much.
Right, or sleep, or food.
Yeah.
You know, it's the irony in Japan is that actually becoming a hit mangaka, it seems like that would be the dream. I'm a hit, I'm rich, I can retire. But in fact, it's like a white elephant. When you hit it big, suddenly the volume of work you need to increase, you needed to turn in increases dramatically to the point where no single human can do it. You basically have to become a manager of a team, you know, and it's just, you know, weekly deadlines. In America, you know, it's like, what is it? A comic book is maybe a couple dozen pages once a month. These guys have to turn that in week after week after week. And it can be pretty brutal.
Yeah, I think by some standards, Toriyama was saying he was drawing 500 pages a year,
that's how do these guys not get like carpal tunnel syndrome, like slip discs? I mean, maybe they probably
that's
do.
That's what I was just thinking.
Yeah.
But as we implied, I mean, the manga itself is a hit, but I think what catapults him to superstardom is the fact that Dr. Slump becomes an anime, you know, on Fuji Television in 1981. As Matt mentioned, the anime is renamed Dr. Slump Arai-chan. They put her name in the title. She's very front and center in all the advertisements and the artwork. This stat blew my mind, though. I looked this up. So Dr. Slump Arai-chan premieres in 1981 at 7 p.m. on Wednesday on Fuji Television. And for the next 18 years, that time slot is reserved for Toriyama-themed animations. Like, as soon as Arai-chan ends, Dragon Ball takes over. And when that ends, Dragon Ball Z takes over. And when that all ends, Dragon Ball GT takes over. And when that ends, a revival of Dr. Slump takes over. Like, so from 81 to 99, 7 p.m. Wednesday night, you are, you know, almost 20 years of human beings are watching television, and it's Toriyama's artwork looking back at them. And just for reference sake, what takes it over? Goddamn One Piece. So,
you know, although on that topic
is kind of he feels like this is a successor in a lot of ways, though, right?
Honestly, there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah, he really looked up to Toriyama. There's an interview between them in one of the first One Piece art books. It's a rare interview with Toriyama. And I was thinking upon the death of Toriyama, this is not a popularity contest. One Piece has ran a lot longer than Dragon Ball. It seems much more popular in terms of like present popularity, but he was kind of siloed in the One Piece factory from the age of 22 onwards. So he could not touch as many things. He could not create multiple series, work on video games. It's just him and One Piece for the past 27 years, I think, at this point, coming up on 27 years. So right. might be more popular, but not the same cultural legacy yet.
Right.
Yeah, and like Matt said, I mean, like once something becomes a hit, it becomes a hit, and like that's what you're known for. And I think there are plenty of anecdotes along the way with Dr. Slump and later with Dragon Ball, where it's like Toriyama's like, okay, so this story's wrapping up, right? And its editors are like, no, this is not wrapping up. What do you mean?
You're never stopping. You're never wrapping up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Jump, though. I mean, you know, these people are, you know, rightly, I don't mean to, you know, minimize anyone's connection to these properties, but they're not like artistic explorations for art's sake. They are products. And when they sell well, they're designed to continue and continue and continue, which is why we have like, you know, is 1,000, how many episodes of One Piece are there? How many episodes of Dragon Ball are there? And they've been continuing for like, Dragon Ball has been going on for like 40 years now. It's wild. I don't know if there's any other entertainment project besides perhaps like the James Bond series or something that's been going on for as long as this, as successfully as this, and is like evolving to get new groups of demographics of watchers and users like Dragon Ball has. It's pretty wild.
I mean, if you look at things with long legacies, you know, they're out there, but they're inevitably handed off to different people over the decades.
Right.
Where in the case of Dragon Ball, like from its inception, it was Toriyama, and even when they brought it back, you know, for Dragon Ball Super, you know, they went back to Toriyama. Like he, you know, at that point he was always successful. It's like, I'm not drawing this for you, but he was still, the writer. He designed a lot of characters for it. And by all accounts, he was writing new material right up until his passing, you know, for Super, which is an ongoing revival.
Was he actually doing scripts? He must've just been doing like overviews and then people would flesh it out. I mean, because that's
presumably, I'm not sure.
I'm just from here. I mean, if I got to that level, you know, and I will in just a couple of years, I'm sure I'm going to be at Toriyama's level. You know, once you get to that level, you want to outsource as much as you possibly can. And so like, you know, he's like the big picture, and I'm sure the actual dialogue writing and stuff, which is kind of the grunt work of script writing, was done by other people. You know, and you know, his characters, that's why Enix hired him to do the characters for Dragon Quest. It's why Square did for Chrono Trigger, you know? So it makes sense that he would do those aspects of it. And then his most recent, I guess, is Sandland, right? That was just only recently became, it's been around for a while, but it only recently became an anime, correct?
Yeah. Sandland is one of the weirdest stories here. It's like after all the hits we've already rattled off here, in 2000, he basically puts out a 14 chapter story called Sandland in Shonen Jump. And, you know, it's a manga, it does well, it's got his name on it, it looks good. And then it sort of sits idly for about 20 years, and then all of a sudden, like, about 2 years ago, they said, okay, it's coming out now. And they made an animated movie last year, which I think is coming to Western territories later in 2024. Mm-hmm. There's a weekly streaming series which is coming out very soon as it's recording, but it's not out yet, so he didn't get to see it in action. But I know he wrote more material for that, and they said he created more characters for that. And there's an open world video game, which is also coming very soon. Not out as it's recording, but Sandland existed for about 2 decades, and all of a sudden in the last 2 years, it has become a multimedia project. When before that, it was just a manga sitting around. So I haven't read it yet, but I played the demo at TGS. You can read my preview for it at last year's TGS. You know, it's very thoughtful and nuanced.
Yeah, now that you mentioned it, Diamond, they recently, within the past couple of years, they did a remake of the more popular Dragon Quest anime, and that was recently a game too. So they've been really reviving these dormant Toriyama things in recent memory.
Digging in the crates, as hip hop artists would say.
Yeah, I get the sense that once they did that Dragon Ball Battle of the Gods movie, everyone remembered, like, oh yeah, Toriyama's great. What if we just, like, dig into that library some more?
You're right, Kevin. That's probably the flashpoint. You know, when they made more Dragon Ball for the first time in decades, like, oh wait, we could just do this. He's still here. And obviously, he wouldn't be here forever, as we sadly know. But, like, I'm happy that it happened, and I'm happy that he got a chance to see more people connect with the stuff he made. Even if it's decades old at this point, people are still out there reconnecting with all his old material, and it holds up wonderfully because it's you know, I think it has a lot of his timeless quality because of, you know, how he puts his energy into the stuff. You know, all the stuff we mentioned, even though the themes are very different, the characters are different, like, how many things are the same? Like, you've got this world, and it's kind of a near future world where it's like cities are kind of like bubbles, but you still have cars and motorcycles, but you have, like, you know, the Capsule Corporation where people throw things in the ground and they spring into full houses. You've got animals and humans living side by side. Like, you know, the animals could talk to people, the people talk to animals, but there's dinosaurs running around, and there's entire stretches of the earth that are just giant, you know, like plateaus of, like, you know, random rock crags. Like, that's just earth. You've got aliens, you've got UFOs, you've got monsters, you've got, like, little characters of Ultraman clinging to trees and buzzing like cicadas. Like, all this stuff coexists, and no one questions any of it.
I think he Toriyama's legacy is really that he kind of absorbed all of this sort of widely spread disparate Japanese pop culture. You know, you see aspects of tokusatsu, you know, which is live action sci-fi like Ultraman and things like that. You see aspects of like Doraemon, you know, who has that pocket where he can pull any gadget out of. That's the capsule stuff in the Capsule Corporation stuff. You see the kind of squashed character designs, which had, he wasn't the first to invent them, but I think you can argue that he perfected them. And, you know, his draftsmanship is just really impeccable. I would actually put him up there with somebody like Otomo. I think he could draw like Akira's Otomo if he chose to, but instead he chose this more rounded, silly kind of format, but yet he's often telling these kind of wild tales with it. So he laid the groundwork for a lot of the stuff. He synthesized this kind of new synthetic, like, you know, One Piece, to use a term, excuse me, like singular Japanese pop culture from a lot of different sources. And I'm speaking of One Piece. Oda, in his kind of tribute, obituary, whatever you want to call to Toriyama, said something like, he took the baton from an era when manga was seen as trash culture, junk culture. It was believed that reading manga would make you stupid. That's what people thought about manga in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, even when I hear about this from my wife, her parents wouldn't let her read manga in the house. You had to do it kind of illicitly. You had to do it, you know, secretly. Otherwise, you get yelled at by your teachers and your parents and stuff. Toriyama made it something that everybody could enjoy. He raised the level of it. Even though he's, you know, drawing, like, talking poop and stuff, he was so good at what he did. He just elevated the entire medium into what it became. And now it's this seen as this global Japanese culture. It's like the biggest, Japan's biggest export. If you ask Japanese people in the 80s, like when they're riding high, like exporting like washing machines and computers and cars, where are we going to be 40 years from now? We're going to be supporting the entire country by exporting anime and manga? They would have called you crazy, but that's the kind of reality that we live in. And I think it's due in huge, huge part to Toriyama.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to talk about any one work that he did because so much of it has such far-reaching potential. But it's like, on top of all the, you know, decades of manga we've already talked about, it's like, yeah, in between there, he's go ahead and he's called upon to make characters for some of the best received video games ever made. You know, like the Dragon Quest thing comes about because I think it's Torishima at Shonen Jump who's putting his dream
Torishima
together, you know?
Again.
Yeah. He's like, hey, you know, Hori, you're writing over here. Toriyama, you're drawing things over here. You work with you and let's get together. And like, that's the genesis that starts it off. And that becomes, you know, a hit and then a bigger hit. And then, you know, I promise you, in the hours after Toriyama's passing was announced here in Japan, I saw the February 1988 footage of long lines for buying Dragon Quest III all over Japanese TV for days. That's all they were showing. Like, that's, you know, this is what we remember him for, is, oh yeah, he drew all these characters, and that's what took over Japan for decades now.
And really, it makes you wonder, would Dragon Quest have even taken off without the packaging and the character designs of Toriyama? I think it's very questionable. I mean, there were other role-playing games like Wizardry and stuff on the market in Japan. Dragon Quest, I worked on it. I love Dragon Quest, but it's evolutionary. It is absolutely not revolutionary. You know, to someone who had grown up playing Ultima, it was like, oh, okay, well, this is like Ultima you can play with a joystick instead of a keyboard. But those characters just took it to another level altogether. And, I don't know. They're like the secret sauce of so much of Japanese pop culture is that kind of design work and Toriyama's in particular.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier because I had seen someone had posted the original draft of what Hori had for the slime what Toriyama sent back. And I thought to myself, like, you know, first, you know, obviously Toriyama's line is adorable and very, like, charming, but also this was very sensible because this is going to be the first monster you're going to encounter in this game, and it has to set the tone for the entire thing. And you just have this goofy, smiling teardrop. And I remember the first time I saw that as a kid, I'm like, okay, this is amazing. I want to play more of this game. And, you know, I don't think that would have happened if you didn't have Toriyama working on the designs for this.
Was that your first exposure to kawaii culture?
It's either that or Grimm's Fairy Tales, the anime that they used to show on Nickelodeon.
Oh, wow. Was that Japanese?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I was thinking of the games that Toriyama made art for that aren't Dragon Quest, and I think none of them would have gotten sequels if not for Toriyama. Things like Tobal, Go Go Ackman, which is based on like a very short manga he made. What else? Oh, Blue Dragon, that got an anime and that got a DS sequel. All of these things that were just capitalizing on his style that would not have been popular. And of course, Chrono Trigger. I'm still waiting for that sequel. A good sequel with his art, by the way. Take that, Chrono Cross fans.
They're getting the pitchforks.
They knew who they are.
Aren't they Jeremy?
It could just be Jeremy and two other guys at this point.
Okay. Where is Jeremy, by the way? Where is he?
He couldn't make it. He couldn't make it today. I'm sorry. The timing didn't work out.
Oh, well.
But, yeah. So, yeah, the Dragon Quest thing happens because he's involved. You know, obviously, that builds in the Chrono Trigger thing. And, yeah, Bob, you mentioned Blue Dragon. I mean, that's from an era where Microsoft is pouring millions and millions of dollars into this console. And they're like, how do we get Japan to buy our gosh darn video games? They're not buying these Xboxes. And someone's like, hey, what if we get the Dragon Ball guy to do something? And they get Blue, you know, and that's how you get Blue Dragon. Like, that's
right.
That's the main impetus there, right?
And it is Sakaguchi. It is Mistwalker, I believe, working with Toriyama. And I will say that is a solid B- RPG. All of you people bugging Sony to make a Bloodborne PC port, bug Microsoft to make a Blue Dragon PC port. I think they'll do it if they find out anyone is interested. It's an all right game that has a lot of charm, mostly thanks to Uematsu's soundtrack and Toriyama's artwork.
You know, now's the time. Strike while the iron's hot.
It's a little warm.
Well, you know, this is actually part and parcel of the way that, you know, artists are commodified here. You know, there's so many people working in Toriyama's style now for him. There's so many assistants, so many people who have done this, so many people. And his style is so, I'd say it's inimitable, which it is in a kind of conceptual sense, but it's incredibly imitable if you are told to draw something in Toriyama's style. And I think we will be seeing, I wouldn't be shocked at all if they find like old storylines that weren't used, old, you know, famously Torishima like shot down something like 500 to 1,000 pages of ideas that Toriyama had submitted to Shonen Jump in the early 80s. And so I could totally see some of that stuff being unearthed and resurrected. And people are cool with that here. I mean, it's understood that when you become as big as Toriyama, you become an industry. It's like Toriyama Inc., Bird Studios.
Yeah, so, Bird Studios, yeah.
You know, definitely. I was actually really, really, when we were working on Dragon Quest VIII, we had, you know, and we had to rename a lot of the monsters in there. We were given stacks of the old strategy guides. And I was really, really shocked to learn that one of my friends had illustrated the strategy guide for Dragon Quest II. It looks just like Toriyama. And it was actually, I can't remember if it was two or three, but it's Yutaka Kondo, my manga artist friend who illustrated Hiroko and my Ninja Attack series book. And he had been hired because Toriyama doesn't want to, by that point, he doesn't want to draw like all of the page illustrations for these books. But so the point being here is that, yeah, I think we are going to see other artists picking up the torch and being asked to kind of draw in his style and do things in his style.
Yeah, it's kind of like every few years we get another Beatles song, you know?
Right.
Somehow, right. There's always...
Where are those coming from?
There's always one more recording. There's always one more, you know, there's always one more tape found in a shoebox in Sheffield or Liverpool.
This is totally off topic, but you guys, I'm sure, know the story of what Koji Kondo, the Nintendo's composer, you know, Super Mario, Zelda, everything. And he goes to a Beatles concert and like, and Paul McCartney's like, oh my God, you know, like the Super Mario theme guy. And like, and Paul McCartney is flipping out at meeting Koji Kondo. I actually think that, you know, Japanese people tend to think of themselves as, and Japanese creators as these kind of, you know, oh, we're these, you know, nobody cares about us. We're in this tiny island way off in the Pacific. You know, who would care? That's why I'm not even going to tell you what my name is or draw my face. But yeah, Toriyama is a Beatle to a lot of people. You know what I mean? Koji Kondo is too. You know, so is Yuji Horii. So is, you know, Miyamoto Shigeru. They had a planet sized, you know, impact. Starting to sound like a Dragon Ball metaphor here, on global pop culture. And it's just, it's why this is such a shock. You know, I'm still in shock about this. I really, 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 really wanted at some point to meet, you know, to get hired to do a piece on him or on one of his new, you know, creations and get to meet him, because honestly, Dr. Slump is the manga that made me fall in love with manga as a kid. I found it through Japanese friends who had untranslated copies. And like in my group of American friends, these comic books started to, the tankobon started to circulate, and we're like, what is this? Like, what is going, you didn't even really need Japanese to understand it. You know, like Mad Magazine came up as a metaphor a few minutes ago, and it totally is Mad Magazine, you know?
Yeah. I don't think I found out about Dr. Slump until like the 2000s or so, like well after Dragon Ball had become popular. I think I started looking on the internet and, you know, looking up who made it and finding out, oh, there was another thing before that. And yeah, long before, you know, anyone actually officially licensed it, I think I just found like fan subs online and just like,
right,
what is, yeah, it's like, it's the reaction, like, yeah, what's going on here? That's a little girl. Okay. And she's super strong, but also like, yeah, there's talking poop and there's animals everywhere. And again, another theme, you know, just like his very first creation had the Nikuman Superman character. Dr. Slump has his own Superman character, which is Supaman. And the joke there.
Yes.
Yeah. Sour the joke man. There being that Supai in Japanese is like very sour. So he eats something very sour and he becomes a superhero, but he can't actually fly. So he just lays down on a skateboard and zips around town. Like that's the kind of stuff we're working with here. And it's hilarious.
Brilliant.
But it's also like, brother, what's happening?
When my brother-in-law got married, the MC at the wedding was the voice actor who played Superman, and he kept doing Superman lines. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And he's like the wedding singer now. You know, but like literally he'd say, hi, I'm Superman. And like the whole crowd would be like, whoa, Superman. You know, it's just, but before he's bigger than Christopher Reeves.
Before the manga came to the West, the Dr. Slump manga, the anime has never been officially translated or anything. It really was a footnote for Dragon Ball fans, because RLA makes a canonical appearance in Dragon Ball. She is the one who defeats General Blue. Like Goku runs to Penguin Village as part of the story. It's a big crossover in the manga and the anime. And then the footnote was like, oh, I guess he did this other thing before Dragon Ball. Who cares? And then people eventually find out how good it is when it's brought over to us in the early aughts.
I mean, it was as big as Dragon Ball in the 80s. I mean, as somebody who kind of experienced that a little bit indirectly in real time, I mean, it was just giant, 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 giant. So if you talk to people in Japan in their 60s, their 50s, who grew up in Japan at that time, that they'll tell you just what he could have retired after that. A wealthy, wealthy man. He could have just been like, you know what? I'm done. I'm 25 years old. I've done this. I've sold 35 million copies of something, you know, job well done, Akira, you know, but he didn't, he kept going, you know, he just kept going and going and going.
He said to himself, I have to take over the entire world of pop culture thanks to cheap anime exports.
You know, he was smart though. I was looking at his biography and I noticed that he kind of got out of the grind at around 40.
Right.
I mean, he was still working. He was still doing a smaller series, but Dragon Ball ended in 95. I assume, was he born in 55? Is that his birth
date? Yeah, I think, yeah, he's 68 this year, so, yeah.
Yeah, so he was 40, and like so many creators work far longer than that on the same grind. So he was smart in that respect.
Yeah. Well, boys, I hate to do this, but I have somewhere I need to be very shortly, so I'm going to have to bail out. But please continue discussing in my absence if you want.
Matt, before you go, do you just want to tell people about the things you work to the people of the audience?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, I'm Matt Ault again, as always. You can find me on, I'm on Twitter, Matt_Ault. I'm on Instagram, @MattAult. I have a newsletter that I've been doing, which is blog.pureinventionbook.com. And that is a kind of expansion of my book, Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. Thank you for showing that there. You can find it at your local bookstore or wherever books are sold, or listen to it. I narrated it over three very long, long days that made me realize I never want to be a voice actor. so please, but thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. I think this is my third time on the podcast, maybe fourth. I don't know.
I've lost count, but we call you when we need a heavy hitter about the giants of Japan, such as Godzilla or Gogo 13. So
yes, we did the Gogo 13 thing. I remember that. Yes. That was a top secret episode, I believe. So anyway, yes. Sorry to bail out halfway through, but please continue and, let's do this again sometime soon.
Yes, thank you for joining us, Matt. Matt's gone. Now we have some air for the rest of us. I know, right? No. Kidding. I'm kidding. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Dragon Ball a little more in depth, just because we can't not touch on what makes Dragon Ball great, even though I honestly believe Dragon Ball deserves its own episode, which hopefully is coming soon, because, we're recording this in 2024, which is the 40th anniversary of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
And to me, what I think is so funny about Dragon Ball is the fact that it starts off as basically a take on Journey to the West, which is this, very famous Chinese story that lots of people have adapted over the years, both in Japan and China, and like lots of people. I mean, we talked about Tezuka earlier. Like, Tezuka did his own version of Journey to the West. Like, lots of people done, Stephen Chow has done Journey to the West,
Just One Piece is also kind of Journey to the West. The main character's name is Monkey. It's no coincidence.
Yeah. There's like a million games that are Journey to the West that aren't Dragon Ball. It's everywhere.
Right. And in this case, Toriyama took the literal character, who in Chinese is Sun Wukong, and just the same kanji, and just reads them in the Japanese way, which is Son Goku. And I think the son name doesn't really get a lot of play overseas, but here in Japan, it very much is Son Goku. And I, to this day, I remain disappointed my wife wouldn't let me name our son Goku, because that would be the perfect joke. Like, here's my son Goku, but I'm sorry. In either way,
Toriyama would appreciate a pun of that level, I think.
Yeah. I hope so, because even though Dragon Ball is a more serious story, like as far as like there's combat, there's life, there's death, there's war, there's still lots of goofballs. There's still lots of, quasi-perverted characters. I would say this time around, his insert character is the old man who just wants to read pornography and be left alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this was one that I actually did catch the original dub airing of it back in, 94 or so, 95?
Oh, me too, and yeah.
I really liked it. I thought it was hilarious at the time, and they did censor and re-edit a lot of the hornier jokes, which, you know, Dragon Ball had a ton of horny jokes, especially early on. I honestly don't know what they thought they were doing trying to dub it for kids in the US in the 90s, given how it progresses. But yeah, I really liked it. And I remember being extremely disappointed when they announced a new season and it just jumped straight to Dragon Ball Z. And I'm like, this isn't funny anymore. What the heck?
Yeah, yeah, like Kevin, I got in on the ground floor just because I happened to be up at, 6 a.m. on a Saturday, which was the weird-ass time my local Fox affiliate would air it. And then I jumped to Cartoon Network when Toonami started airing the reruns. But a funny thing happened. When they got through the 52 episodes of Dragon Ball Z, there was maybe like an 18-month or two-year wait before they dubbed more. And in that time, I became a huge snob and I moved on from Dragon Ball. I was like, I enjoy more the Cowboy Bebops of the world and the Studio Ghibli films, if you will. I'm swirling a brandy glass as I talk. And then only much like in my 30s, I came back and I thought, well, I was stupid. This is great. And last year, actually, is the time when I watched through the original Dragon Ball series in its entirety for the first time.
And it's just a good time, right? I mean, I haven't seen it all by myself, but yeah, it's like, so much of it is just fun and entertaining, but it's also like there's still plenty of people like throwing, you know, laser beams at each other, but it's also like funny.
And it has great pacing, even in the anime form. That's back when the episode counts weren't as bloated as they are today. Like we're talking with Matt, One Piece has 1,100 episodes. And when you watch some of those episodes, they're just adapting one chapter over the course of 22 minutes. And it's kind of excruciating at times.
Yeah, whereas the original Dragon Ball, it's very breezy. You know, everyone makes the joke about Dragon Ball Z just like dragging things out because of how much they drug out the Frieza fight.
Yeah, Dragon Ball, right? Yeah.
Just to let Toriyama catch up and like get ahead of them enough to keep it going. But yeah, the early stuff, it has a great flow to it. I have not gotten to see the entirety of the original Dragon Ball, but everything I have seen, it's... The gags are just really, really good. They're really clever, even when they're dumb. Just the like Krillin beating people in their big tournaments by using, what was it, his like smelly shoes. And it didn't work on him himself because he doesn't have a nose. Just because Toriyama never drew one on him. And like that's great. That is really dumb, but it's really great.
And there's an arc where they basically have to fight all of the Universal movie monsters, which I really enjoyed.
And the Terminator.
Terminator's there too. Yes, Goku does fight the Terminator, and that's not to be missed.
Yeah, I when I think about Dragon Ball, I also think about how, and I think a lot of people have highlighted this in recent weeks with his passing, you know, Toriyama got a lot of attention for his silly little guys and his muscle men and his babes, but also he had a sort of oddball fashion sense to the characters he created. You know, like Arane-chan, I know, like wears a lot of weird little outfits because I think he said he just got tired of drawing the same one every time. So like he would ever just wear different costumes for fun. And even though Goku tends to wear the same outfits all the time, like certainly Bulma has an array of outfits that she puts on different scenarios. She gets different haircuts over the series, you know, as she grows up and, you know, matures as a woman. And just, you know, Dragon Ball and later Dragon Ball Z is also full of like lots of weird outfits and costumes. Like I'm thinking of the guy, the name escapes me, but the guy who's hired to kill Goku, like he just has a shirt that says killer on it. Like it's like killer on the back. And it's got the kanji for kill on the front. Like, I love, you know, I just think that's such a strong look. And of course, people today still talk about Vegeta's Batman pink shirt. Like, that's legendary. The Batman shirt.
That's a fit.
Yeah. And of course, you know, viewers at home or listeners aren't going to see this, but I'm podcasting as I have done for many years now, wearing this officially licensed Goku bathrobe. It's bright orange. It's got the Goku... The Go of Goku is on the front, and I think it's on the back, too. I can't see my back here. But if you haven't heard the story for this, people ask me all the time, where'd you get the robe? I bought this robe at Disney World, okay? So Akira Toriyama, little kid inspired by Disney cartoons and Tezuka, creates a character that becomes so goddamn world famous, they sell his merch at Disney World. Dramatic pause. Like, that's seriously, like... That's the magnitude we're talking about. That's the level. That's the Toriyama power level.
I mean, I, you know, after his passing, I started noticing all of the slimes that were around my condo. And it was like I started a recording with someone via Zencastr. We have the video windows here that the listeners can't see. There's a slime hanging behind me. And the person said, oh, did you hang that up because of Toriyama's passing? And I thought, oh, it's always been there. And I started looking around and they're just slimes are surrounding me. Little Toriyama creatures are surrounding me throughout my condo. It helped that we just went to Japan and bought little Dragon Quest monsters left and right.
That'll do it. I did make a joke earlier about how this got imported around the world, and it really did. This is like one of those things that I feel Dragon Ball Z in particular is very globally recognized because a lot of, you know, TV stations would air anime because it was cheap to put on the air. You didn't have to make it yourself. And I know, like, it was huge in Latin America, and I remember watching a video when Dragon Ball Super had its finale episode, and I think it's probably still on YouTube, of just, like, this big crowd outdoors in Mexico watching the final, like, fight sequence, and just, like, cheering and, like, chanting for, like, Frieza, Frieza, Frieza. I'm like, holy crap, this is so much bigger overseas, or, I guess, same continent, but, you know, in other countries than, like, I even consider in the U.S., where it is also quite big. And that's just cool. Like, yeah, someone made a joke about how there's that statue in, I think, Florida of Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse. And they're like, someone should erect that in Mexico City with Toriyama and Goku. I'm like, they should. That's honestly real. He is an unofficial Mexican citizen.
I do hope that in the coming years we see a lot of Toriyama statues erected around the world, because it's where he belongs. Like, his creations have touched everyone. I know, I think it's House of Decline, the online cartoonist, did a cartoon that predates Toriyama's passing, but he shared it again to like 16,000 retweets. And it's just these two guys overseas, and like, yeah. Are you going to be making this trip? Like, you don't speak any Arabic. It's like, it's all right. I speak the universal language. And he just walks through a market, opens his shirt, and it's Goku on his shirt. And you see a guy's like, oh, Goku. It's like, yeah, that's the level of fame we're talking about here. Like, those characters are globally known. I mean, whatever Dr. Slump did for Toriyama here in Japan, like, it made him instant celebrity. But, like, Dragon Ball made him world famous. That made him a global celebrity, you know, on par with, I don't say on par with, I think he's one of the most famous Japanese people, like, ever. I really do. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of other people, like, made famous things. Like, Shigeru Miyamoto made a lot of famous things, but I don't think Shigeru Miyamoto is famous unless you play a lot of video games and you also, like, read about them. Like,
yeah.
My mother wouldn't know it, either one, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean,
Toriyama's got a lot bigger reach.
We were talking about international appeal. Since the passing of Toriyama, I've been reading a lot on Twitter just how much Dragon Ball has meant to both Black and Latin American audiences and, you know, people outside of America. But I guess up until a certain point, the stereotype a non-Japanese anime nerd was a white guy, perhaps with a ponytail, who knows. But I think Dragon Ball changed what the typical anime fan looked like to a more international kind of person. It wasn't just the nerdy white guy ordering tapes out of Anamerica. It was people of all races.
Everyone loves Piccolo.
Yes.
That's right. We talked for over an hour. We didn't even mention the name Piccolo. Yeah, Piccolo's a legend unto himself, I think, because mm-hmm. he's this sort of strange character who was initially a villain, and then he dies and comes out of an egg again. But then he just, you know, when the series transitions to larger threats that come from outer space, all of a sudden Piccolo transitions into sort of an angry but understanding sort of tutor and mentor for Goku's suddenly orphan son. And again, one of the tweets that went around in Toriyama's passing, like, someone's like, yeah, Toriyama never went to America, but somehow he nailed the archetype of, you know, guy who goes to prison, converts to Islam, and suddenly becomes a big brother for, you know, street kids. Like, that's Piccolo. Piccolo is this mean villain who, you know, sort of overcomes his gruffness and is, you know, over time falls in love with this kid he's sort of been training to become a martial artist, and then, you know, eventually gives up his own life to save Gohan's life. And then, you know, years later, he's just one of the guys. He's just a pal. But still.
He's Gohan's real dad.
Yeah.
I feel bad for him because Piccolo's dad, you never got to meet him because as his dad was dying, he barfed out an egg, and that's where Piccolo was born.
Does he still know to celebrate King Piccolo Day, though? Because it is coming up very quickly.
Oh, you're right about that. I need to plan my party.
Yeah, we have noticed that the episode's going up, but yeah, I know April, I think April 5th is Toriyama's birthday, and I don't know, when is King Piccolo Day? I don't know off the top of my head.
Isn't it like May 15th or something weird like that?
Let's look that up. Listeners, look that up. Look that up. Make sure to check your local time zone to you don't miss any of these holidays this year.
It's May 9th. 2 days after my birthday, hail King Piccolo.
Well, under the circumstances, Bob, I think we understand the listeners, if they eschew giving you gifts and just celebrate King Piccolo Day this year, is that all right?
I understand. Yeah, I will understand that.
It's going to be a very dark King Piccolo Day.
I feel like we could sort of start wrapping this up because I believe Dragon Ball, the magnitude of Dragon Ball itself probably deserves its own episode in the near future. But I just the hype, what's happened, I really feel like if we haven't said it enough, I honestly believe Akira Toriyama is one of the most influential artists of the last 40 years. And I say that knowing that he spent the last 20 years just enjoying his success. You know what I mean? Like, as you mentioned, Bob, he got out of the grind of manga when he turned 40. And even though he never stopped working, like, he didn't retire, but, like, he stopped doing the weeklies. He would just do, like, he'd do little things, he'd do collaborations, he would create characters for this, he'd create new characters for this. I believe it was Dragon Ball FighterZ with a Z. You know, he made a new Android for that, and the internet lost its mind. Like, oh my god, new Toriyama Android, I love her. Like, that was like a Bowsette-level, you know, reaction. I think total coincidence here because, you know, Akira is a common name, but, like, we credit Akira, the 88 animated film, as sort of, like, breaking through anime fandom in the West, but I think it's Akira Toriyama's work is what really made it all stick. It really made it popular. His characters took over, you know, they were airing on cable every day, then all of a sudden, they're on every t-shirt in the mall, like, Hot Topic, I don't know how much money Hot Topic sent Toriyama over the years, but it's not enough. It's not enough.
You go to the flea market, get all your bootleg airbrushed Dragon Ball Z club shirts. There were a lot of those in the late 90s and early 2000s. I think Akira is a good comparison point because, yeah, Akira, it got some people to notice anime was a thing outside of the very specific nerd circles, but I don't think it was really mainstreamed until you had Dragon Ball Z and I guess Sailor Moon because they were sort of airing at about the same time.
It doesn't help that there's only 2 hours of Akira, meanwhile there are hundreds of hours of Dragon Ball and Sailor Moon to have fun with.
Yeah.
Once you watch Akira, you're done. It's like, well, what else? I guess you can read the manga.
It's very different. It's very different. Yeah.
Not digitally, though. Boo.
I have a quote here from Nadia Oxford, Nadia Oxford, excuse me, writing for 1UP many, many years ago. Nadia wrote, Akira Toriyama is the definitive shonen mangaka. He can design heroes whose strength and cunning transcend generations, but he's also famous for his compellingly silly monsters.
Well said.
Yeah. And another comment that went around a lot of after Toriyama's passing was from Hirohiko Araki, the JoJo guy, who we've also talked about a lot in this podcast. Araki said, back in the day, people would always be reading manga on the train. It didn't matter if you were 10 meters away. All it took was a quick glance at the corner of the page, and you could instantly tell, oh, that's Dragon Ball. That manga has its own unique aura. You know a manga is good when even children can sense that. And if I could do one more quote here, just from from SSJ Speed Racer on Twitter, but I really think this nails it. It's like, imagine being the guy who designed the Dragon Quest slime, and that's not even the main thing you're known for. Like, yeah, that's what happened. You know, like, we've made our jokes about glow-ups and how important his characters are, but it's like, yeah, one of the biggest characters he's ever made is not even the biggest character he made. And that's the reality of his popularity.
I mean, Diamond, you live in Japan. I was just there for 2.5 weeks, and you can't get Dragon Ball stuff in every store, but within a 50 meter radius of wherever you're standing, there is a slime for sale that you can buy, either via a claw machine, a UFO catcher, a gift shop. There has to be some kind of slime available, or it's a national emergency.
Yeah, and it's all going to ramp up again. I mean, even without his untimely passing, the media train had already started for the Sandland stuff that's coming soon, because the series, again, I don't know when this is going up, but as of this recording, the series is going to start streaming very soon. I believe it's streaming in March 2024, so probably within a week of our recording, and the game is coming out, I think, April 2024, so, like, they've already started the hype machine for these things, and it's only going to increase because of what happened, and it's just... You know, I believe the quote, I think it was Oda from One Piece who said, like, I hope Toriyama finds heaven to be exactly as happy a place as he expected it to be, because, you know, so much of Dragon Ball involves the afterlife. I forget the term for it, not Randian, but, like, there's a term for it where you have fiction that involves characters going to and from the afterlife, and, like, there's afterlife characters and real-life characters, and, like... That's a big part of Dragon Ball. In Dragon Ball, the characters die. It's not the end. They just go to the place where dead people go, and they hang out there. And sometimes they visit us because they know the people who are in charge. And I think Oda's like, yeah, like, I hope if that's how it works, like, I hope Toriyama goes up there and he's like, oh, that's great. Everyone already knows who I am here. You know what I mean? People are drawing comics of him meeting, like, King Emma. It's like, yeah, yeah. Oh, great. It's good to see you. You're the best. We're happy to meet you. And... I can't imagine, like, what other compliment is there. It's like, oh, this guy who created all these characters created an entire universe to sort of occupy. We can only hope that he got it right and that he's enjoying it, you know, even wherever he is now.
Yeah, yeah, I think you really nailed something with that. Maybe the universal appeal of Dragon Ball comes from the fact that as self-aware creatures, we're all terrified of death and what awaits us. But in this manga series, death is just like a vacation you can come back from. And that's very reassuring, you know, as we're all marching towards the grave.
Yeah, I feel like there were two major creator passings that really, like, hit me. And one was Terry Pratchett, and the other has been Akira Toriyama. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say, really. It's just...
I mean, there's similarities there, Kevin, right? I mean, because Terry Pratchett wrote a lot about a version of death who was, you know, distinct.
And he also wrote about some very universal topics as well. Not quite the same degree as Toriyama, but yeah, just it's very weird seeing the legends of your time passing and knowing that, like, that's that. Like, yeah, there's a lot of old materials of Toriyama's that they will inevitably trudge out, but I don't know. I don't think it'll have quite the same spark to it without him, you know, putting together these gags and these character designs and everything.
Yeah, I mean, Square Enix has already announced Dragon Quest XII, so presumably they're already deep involved in production, but we have no idea how much Toriyama finished or didn't finish for that game. It's still, you know, as it's recording, does not even have a release date, so... Going forward, obviously that series is going to keep going, but they're going to have to figure out how to make do without him. The Dragon Ball Super manga is ongoing. That's obviously going to have to make do. I think there's some new Dragon Ball product. I think it was just recently announced that I haven't even seen yet that I think is going to have to figure out. Well, Toriyama was involved and he's not here anymore. So it's like so much of what Toriyama created is going to keep going. Like that's sort of, you know, I would say the beauty of art, you know, when you create art, it goes on, it outlives you in a way, like your children. But, you know, it is sort of odd to think about this guy who was such a huge presence and a consistent sort of source of joy. Like he's not here anymore. And we can only hope that he's correct and that we will meet him again. That's sort of, my Japanese opening was taken from the last episode of Dragon Ball GT, which is the title of the show, like where Goku leaves at the end of that series. But it's always like, yeah, we'll see him again when we die and we go wherever he is. And I hope that's true. I really do.
I think what made it shocking is the fact that, you know, Japanese creators love privacy, and I don't blame them. And whenever you hear about a death of a Japanese creator, regardless of what field they're in, it is often days after it's happened. If they're a lesser known person, perhaps weeks or months. Like, oh yeah, that person died 6 months ago. I went to their funeral, and that's a big shock. Whereas in the West, I feel like you know months or years in advance. Like, this person has X condition. Here's what they're dealing with. They're going to write about it. They're going to talk about it. They're going to, let people know what's going on and what time they have left. But with Toriyama, we didn't know what happened. We know what the cause was, but it was like, oh, did he fall? Was there cancer? I was reading like, oh, there was a brain tumor that he was scheduled to have operated on before this. So just the privacy, which I understand, makes it like totally shocking when it just suddenly announced, by the way, this person doesn't exist anymore. Anyways, let's move on. Hey, the State of the Union's on.
Yeah. I did see that like a couple of months ago, he said in an interview that the Dragon Ball Super manga was like in its last arc and was going to wrap up soon. And I kind of wonder if his health had been a factor in that, or if he was just ready to do something else Dragon Ball related. So I don't know. I don't know what to say on that.
I think he issued a statement to a anime festival, I don't know if in Japan or somewhere in the world earlier this year, and people immediately grappled onto it because it was like the last public statement he made. And he sort of hinted at his health because he grew up in a time where, you know, let's be honest, especially in Japan, smoking was everywhere. We know he smoked. I know one of the illustrations that got a lot of play in his passing was, his little self-insert character with the gas mask and the robot hands. Like, the character is seated at like a kotatsu, and there's a can of Coke on the table, and some norimaki senbei crackers, and he's a model kit is on the table, and the character's reading a dirty magazine and saying, yes, yes, I see, yes. And he's got a cigarette and there's a little claw there. And I feel so like, I think Toriyama probably, yeah, he probably, you know, he was 68, he probably had health issues, and maybe he knew things were coming, and he probably didn't know it was happening so soon, but he also kept to himself, and that's just how things are. I mean, his kids, you know, if you look at the timeline, his kids are probably 40-ish, you know, probably close to Bob's age. They're born in the 80s, so he might very well have grandkids at this point, but if so, I don't think he talked about them, and that's just his lifestyle.
Good for them.
Yeah.
I guess we'll wrap things up. I think we've talked enough about this person, and we're going to keep talking about his work in the years to come, because it's going to keep going. Nothing here is going to end. I've been your host this time, Diamond Fight. If you want to find me on the internet, you can look me up at my website, fightclub.me. It's my new website. I made it myself, which honestly, I learned HTML around about the time I discovered Dragon Ball Z, so it's thematically appropriate. F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B. .me. It's my website. And Kevin, do you want to share your credentials?
Sure. I like that. That's how I should start referring to everything. Yes. You can find me on mostly Blue Sky these days under Ubersaurus. I do still have a Twitter presence under that name. Yeah. It's fairly minimal. I do run the Atari Archive video series /book/website. So that's looking at the chronological history of the Atari 2600 library. There is no Dr. Slump to be had there, unfortunately, but maybe some homebrew author can throw me a bone at some point.
Bob?
Hey, it's me, Bob Mackey. You probably know this, but I do other podcasts for the Talking Simpsons Network, including Talking Simpsons, A Chronological Exploration of the Simpsons, and What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every month, and that's all happening wherever you find podcasts. But if you go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you can find all of our bonus stuff, nearly 7 years worth of bonus podcasts. We've covered things like Futurama, King of the Hill, Batman the Animated Series, The Critic, and Mission Hill. And again, that's patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Thank you.
Bob, I'm sure you've done Dragon Ball at some point. Did you what era of Dragon Ball did you talk about on the show?
We actually covered an episode, I believe, in 2020 or 2021 of the original Dragon Ball series. It's one of the fighting tournament episodes.
Okay. Definitely, I would recommend maybe bumping Dr. Slump up in your rotation at some point, because I think that should be probably covered soon.
I'd like to finally watch the anime. I've read a lot of the manga, and the anime looks like very fun, 80s, colorful, bubbly anime.
Yeah. And of course, this has been Retronauts. Thank you very much for listening. I don't know if this is going to be a Patreon episode or not, so I'll just mention the fact that we do produce two exclusive episodes for our patrons every month. That's patreon.com/retronauts. Patrons also have access to our Discord and a weekly column from me, which I very much enjoy writing and reading to you. We're recording this in March of 2024, and this entire month has just been just stacked with legendary video games. I've already done Ninja Gaiden 2004 and Metal Gear the Twin Snakes, and by the time this comes out, I've talked about Bloodlines and Super Metroid all in March of 2024, and that's a fun thing I do, so please tune in for that if you haven't. And I guess we'll just go out today by raising our hands and sending our energy up to Akira Toriyama wherever he is, and we hope you hear us, sensei. We miss you. Good night.